Chaos at the top of the Premier League, and we're going to ignore it, largely. City and Liverpool lose, United and Spurs drop points. We'll touch on that, but once we do, we're going to focus on the bottom of the Premier League, and it's our relegation show. Aston Villa inching forward, Newcastle, the weekend surprise result, and decimated wayward Bournemouth. Well, they're only decimated now. Welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, everybody. My name is Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. We're going to get to the bottom of the table in a minute, and we're going to devote most of the show to it. But first, let's talk about the new chaos at the top of the English Premier League. Kartik Krishnayar, my co-host, coming in now. And I'm going to exercise my privilege as the host of the show to start with a hot take, Kartik. And it's one that I couldn't help but embrace after Saturday's action. Right now, I think the product at the top of the Premier League, Kartik, especially with these favorites that we've been expecting to take over the league, City, Arsenal, United. If you watch soccer to see great athletes and great teams do great things the same way you might watch any of Europe's other leagues, right now the Premier League doesn't appear to be the place for you.
I would agree with that. The Premier League at the top, I think, is weaker at the very top than Germany, than Spain, than maybe Italy. I don't know. Maybe not Italy, and France. Italy's not a great place to watch entertainment either. But as far as balance in the league, and we get into this more in the show, England is it now. In fact, as our listeners know, Christopher Harris and I were in Germany at this time last week. We spent about a week over there. And Leverkusen's CEO even told us, even though they're a corporate-backed team with the and the stereotype in Germany is that Leverkusen has unlimited spending ability, which they don't, but that's the stereotype. They are now being outbid for players by teams at the bottom of the table in the Premier League because they're getting that much more TV money in England. So that tells you something. And Leverkusen's a team that's in Champions League just about every season.
Well, that seems like the debate that we're going to end up centering on as we go through the top of the table here. A weekend after Manchester United again looked poor, City stumbled again, surprisingly. That might end up being the long-term story of the weekend, how much this current City exemplifies what we're going to see later in the season. But we also saw Liverpool stumble on Sunday. Spurs failed to get 3 points. Arsenal did get 3 points. Didn't look great against Sunderland. And only Leicester, the one team that doesn't seem to belong to that group, is actually playing well. And Kartik, I go back and forth with this because I look at the middle of the table and I see good teams, but I don't necessarily see teams that are so much better than the middle of the table in Germany or Spain or Italy. And I just think you look at the results of the Premier League and Champions League, it's pretty clear that the top of the league is just coming back to the pack.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And they're with the exception of Manchester City, who of course were disappointing against Juventus in both games, they're in easy groups. Look, Manchester City's in a group with Mönchengladbach, who's really good right now. I think we might talk about that later in the show. And Sevilla, who have a lot of potential to do damage in Europe, as they've shown in the past. But the other, I thought the Manchester United would walk out of their group, especially given Wolfsburg's previous history in Europe, which hasn't been so good when they've been in European competition. PSV hasn't been good in European competition in almost 10 years, in almost a decade. Arsenal struggling in the group, their struggling is unbelievable to me. And Chelsea's had some hiccups. So it's very – and quite frankly, Spurs have had some hiccups they should not have had in Europa League. I don't know what to make of this. At the same time, when I look at clubs like Stoke and the quality of players they have, and I know I've talked about Stoke a lot this season and Stoke Alona, you just think, well, maybe the middle of the Premier League is better than these other leagues, Crystal Palace also. But then – I take a look at Gary Neville just got the job, right,
at Valencia.
Right, and it's unfortunate that an English coach, an aspiring English coach, has to go to a big club in Spain to get that kind of job because, unfortunately, the big English clubs don't seem to want to hire guys like him. But so he's gone to Valencia, and I thought, okay, let me compare this squad, which is sitting in ninth right now in La Liga, to Premier League squads at the middle of the table. And quite frankly, Valencia is better than most has a better squad than most of the Premier League teams that we're talking about. So, yeah, you might be right. The middle of those leagues. I watched Leverkusen play Schalke last week. Both teams are outside of Champions League places right now in the Bundesliga, and there's more talent on display in that game than in most Premier League games.
And I think it's very difficult to argue about the strength or argue for the strength of the middle of the Premier League when Leicester has cut through that in the last year and a half, just sliced through it. And you see Watford sitting ninth now, and last year they were in the Championship. If the middle of the Premier League was so incredibly strong, like people say, Kartik, the teams that come up from the Championship would be thrown straight back down, unable to cut through all that strength
in
the middle.
More importantly, and I point this out as we're recording this right before MLS Cup, and I used to work for 3.5 years in the second division in the United States, we see a lot of NASL players go to MLS and flop. Only a few have made it and been successful MLS players. So jump from second division to first division in terms of player quality immense in the United States. In England, that's not the case. We're seeing N'Golo pick up where he left off in the Championship. Mahrez was in the Championship 2 seasons ago. He's arguably the best player in the Premier League this season. Jamie Vardy is the leading scorer in the Premier League. He's broken the Premier League scoring records. He was in the Championship 2 seasons ago. Callum Wilson was well on his way to that kind of season before he got injured for Bournemouth. You're seeing some guys who are doing wonderful things for Crystal Palace that were in the Championship just a few seasons ago. I think that that's an indictment of the overall quality of the Premier League. It's not just one or two guys. Oh, Dele Alli also was in League One last season. And he's now the guy that England as a nation is pinning its hopes on for the Euros. So we're not talking about one or two guys. We're talking about like five or six guys.
Well, the Premier League certainly is having a moment on that front. And this weekend they had quite a moment at the top of the table too. Let's start walking down some of these surprise results. Let's start at the Britannia, Kartik, where Stoke City is a team that you and I and Lawrence have talked about a lot on recent shows as a team that's transcending their form by getting good results. This weekend, I certainly think they were the better team against Manchester City, and the lingering question after that 2-0 win where Marko Arnautović had 2 goals is, why is Manchester City continuing to play so poorly?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. I mean, one, the injury list for Manchester City is abnormally long. I don't think anyone is going to deny that. And if you look at the City's team sheet yesterday, they had 4 senior players on the bench, 3 youth players. Now, of course, one of those youth players is Iheanacho, who's proven to be a pretty reliable Premier League performer. But 2 guys I can't remember if it was even Brandon Barker who it was, I can't remember. Was it Maffeo, who the other one, or Manu Garcia, who will never play in a Premier League game unless there's would absolutely be forced to. So that's one point. But I think another point is that there's a lack of leadership in the team when certain guys are injured. Manchester City, despite the reputation of spending big money and buying a club, has had the same core of leaders in the team since around the time of the takeover. 2 in particular, Vincent Kompany and Pablo Zabaleta. Zabaleta has played once this season and is injured again, and Kompany has been on and off injured. It's so noticeable when those 2 guys don't play. And then Yaya Toure is the other kind of leader who communicates with other players, is very demonstrative on the pitch. He's injured. And so you're not getting the kind of leadership you need from guys like De Bruyne, who are new to the club, and Sterling. Kolarov is the one guy who's a bit of a leader that's still left in this playing squad on the field, but he can't do it alone. So I think there's a lack of leadership. And then the third point is the manager, who I have defended for several years now. I love Manuel Pellegrini. I still believe Manchester City do not want to sack him and replace him with Pep Guardiola. I really believe that.
To this point,
I've been proven correct on that. However, Pellegrini's going to have to figure things out, and he's becoming more animated in his press conferences. He's gone from being a very boring interview, a very stereotypical interview who always defends his teams, defends his players, to being quite animated in some of these recent press conferences, beginning with that Liverpool game. So either he's beginning to feel the pressure and come unglued, and he's reacting accordingly with his player selection and team talks, or maybe he's doing it to try and get a response out of the team. But it's a different time. But, Richard, I guess the thing I'll end on with this is that we see these sorts of swoons from City all the time. And this has become an annual thing. And generally it happens when Yaya Toure's not in the team. So maybe that's the silver lining for Manchester City. However, he did play in that Liverpool game and played very poorly. So maybe an indicator that it's beyond just getting Toure back and fixing this.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that even more than ever, teams seem to be taking on the personalities of their manager. And we've implicitly talked about that all season with Arsenal, how Arsene Wenger is so kind of fragile with his reliance on his theory and his plan A that when plan B has to come into effect, we end up seeing some poor results. Jose Mourinho, we see what's going on with Chelsea right now. We see the positives for the most part with Liverpool as they're taking on the personality of their manager. Pellegrini goes through these spells with his teams where he has lulls in the season. It's because he doesn't amp up the tension during those moments. He has a personality that's better served for a long-term approach. And what that means is that Manchester City is going to go through two or three of these spells per season. And two times recently, it hasn't hurt them. They've claimed titles, but we'll see what happens this year as the title race looks more crowded than ever. Let's talk about the top of that title race, Kartik. Leicester City, 3-0 win at Swansea. I don't think we're surprised about this. We'll talk about Swansea's struggles in a minute. But the lingering question with Leicester is how long do we go before we start honestly considering them not only a top four contender, a title contender? And while that question sounds almost trite at this point, I don't think anybody has adequately answered it. After all, neither you nor I nor Lawrence have ever put Leicester in our end of year top fours. Yet here they are, 2 points clear at the top of the Premier League through 15 rounds.
Yeah, and I'm beginning to hedge on that. Not completely. They're not going to be in my top four this week, but overall, the end of the season top four. But I said that there's this seven-match stretch coming up after the international break where they're going to be found out, they're going to be undone, and then they'll fall back to mid-table, and they'll probably finish eighth or ninth in the league. Instead, those first three games of that seven-game stretch have been a win at Newcastle 3-0. I thought that that was going to be a massive correction game where Newcastle was going to come good and Leicester was going to be exposed. Instead, it was the opposite. Leicester ran them off the pitch. And then the 1-1 at home against Manchester United where I missed the second half of the game because I was flying over to this Leverkusen Schalke game, but was able to catch it on German television on repeat that night or the next night, the night of the Leverkusen game, so Sunday night, and felt like Leicester were the far superior team in the second half when they didn't get a goal to win. And then this game against Swansea where they cut them open from about the 10th minute on at the Liberty at a point where you would think Swansea really badly needed a response and a result. So I don't know. The deck seems to be stacked against them, and they keep getting results, and not just results, but resounding results. What were comeback victories against the likes of Aston Villa earlier in the season now are becoming just thumpings of teams that are near the bottom of the table, the kinds of thumpings that Arsenal, Manchester City, and Manchester United should be inflicting to the same competition, but seem completely incapable of doing. So right now, Leicester is the best team in the league.
And I think the one thing that makes this conversation different than the conversations about, say, last year with West Ham and Southampton is the Premier League at the top is not good this year. There's more of an opportunity than ever to not only snare a top six or top four spot, but to snare that number one spot. There's no Chelsea running away with the league this year. In fact, as rounds go by, as results accumulate, we see more fragility, not consolidation with these teams that are supposed to be contending for the title. So even if Leicester slips a little bit, that just means that they're going to be like every other team in the league. And we have to take that more seriously than we would West Ham's lingering top four place last year.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And I think the approach to management now has to be evaluated for other clubs and other managers because Claudio Ranieri has been mocked in the past for his managerial approach. He's a very kind of likable figure in the dressing room. He engages his players. He doesn't rule through fear the way a guy like Jose Mourinho or Roberto Mancini does. He doesn't, or Sir Alex Ferguson with certain players. And this approach of Ranieri, taking players out for pizza, giving them days off, flying them to holiday between games to Norway, which he's done at following this victory at Swansea, is working. The non-fear, hey, if you do well, I'm going to reward you, not keep pushing your buttons approach is working with this squad of players. And it's something that maybe other managers and other clubs have to look at, even though it goes against all of the conventional wisdom in the book now about how you manage professional football players.
We have more teams at the top of the table to talk about. We'll talk about them after this break. But first, let's run down the action across the league on this 15th match day of the Premier League season. On Saturday, Stoke City opened the weekend with two goals from Marko Anatovic and earned a place in the table's top half after a 2-0 win over visiting Manchester City. Southampton, coming off their 6-1 drubbing at the hands of Liverpool midweek, needed a late goal from Oriol Romeu to salvage a 1-1 draw with last place Aston Villa. Jamie Vardy's goal-scoring streak came to an end, but Riyad Mahrez had three goals as Leicester won at Swansea 3-0. Watford is up to ninth after their 2-0 win over visiting Norwich, and Arsenal got goals from Joel Campbell, Olivier Giroud, and a centrally deployed Aaron Ramsey in its 3-1 win over Sunderland. At the Hawthorns, a pair of first-half goals left Spurs drawn with West Brom 1-1. Manchester United played West Ham to a 0-0, of course, and a late goal from Glenn Murray allowed Bournemouth to take a 1-0 win at Chelsea. On Sunday, an own goal from Martin Skrtel and some Jorginho Wijnaldum insurance late in the match gave Newcastle a shock 2-0 win over Liverpool. That win pushed the Magpies to the edge of safety, now even with Bournemouth and Norwich on 13 points, but still in 18th place. One back is Sunderland, and Aston Villa, even after their draw, have only 6 points through 15 rounds. At the top of the table, Leicester City is back in the catbird seat, 2 points ahead of Arsenal. City is next, another point back, with United holding on to 4th place. We're going to take our first break now, come back with a bit of a mea culpa, and then dive into the part of the league we normally save for last, the bottom three and the Premier League's relegation battle. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's time for a little bit of a mea culpa, and I'm sorry, Lawrence McKenna is not going to be with us this week. He had another engagement come up. But at the beginning of last show, we had a really good discussion about Jamie Vardy, a discussion that I was really happy with because I don't think that we do see enough people debating Jamie Vardy the same way that Luis Suarez was debated. Unfortunately, my lack of preparation for that discussion confounded two scandals that happened to Leicester this summer. One, the sex tape scandal that happened during their tour of Asia, and one, Jamie Vardy's racially laced comments at a casino this summer. You can detect even now there's some stumbling in my words as I'm not 100% sure how we got into trouble last week. My research during our show didn't go as smoothly as it should have, so I apologize for that confusion. Kartik, there are a couple of teams that we forgot to talk about during last segment. Let's start with Liverpool, because there was an opportunity with this trip on Sunday to St. James's Park for them to jump right into the title race. Had they won, they would have been within 2 points of Arsenal, and we would have had a completely different discussion than the one that we're going to have. But Jorginho Wijnaldum forcing 2 goals, one an own goal, another that he scored late, gave Newcastle a shock result, one that I'm sure we'll talk about in a few seconds. But does this result, from Liverpool's perspective, change your view of where they are under Klopp?
No, I think they're under Klopp. There is a renewed sense of enthusiasm and energy around the club. They have a lot of injuries, or a fair number of injuries, and he's still figuring out his squad, who plays well where. And in a game like this, it seemed like Christian Benteke was very ineffective as far as the guy you want to deploy up front. I don't think Klopp believes that Daniel Sturridge can give you performances week in and week out with his injury problems and with his fitness issues. So he's mixing and matching. Origi has looked fairly good since Klopp became the manager, and that's a player we know from history at Dortmund that he liked and tried to sign, and he was probably just going to be discarded at Liverpool. So that's a guy that's now worked his way in and looked good midweek in the League Cup. I thought looked pretty good when he came on in this game. But he's still figuring out his squad, and Coutinho's injury doesn't help them. I think Klopp is such a good manager, and again, maybe I'm jaded now because I'm coming back from a trip to Germany where Klopp was the subject because of Christopher Harris and my expertise in English football. Everybody wants to talk to us about Jurgen Klopp in that country. I just sense that regardless of what happens this season with this group of players, next season they're going to be very good, and 2 seasons from now they're probably going to win the league, or at least push to win the league. So maybe too much too soon. Maybe our expectations were too high, given the good work he had done in the first 2 months and the weakness at the top of the league, which I guess is going to be a persistent theme of what we talk about this season.
That weakness opens the door for a team like Spurs, but unfortunately they stumbled this weekend too. 1-1 draw at the Hawthorns. Another team with a manager that's generating a lot of excitement. But Kartik, at some point, I think we need to at least explore the idea that maybe Mauricio Pochettino isn't delivering 3 points where a lot of times Spurs are getting one, this being a prime example.
Yeah.
And as much as we want to be positive about somebody who obviously has such a great effect on Spurs, these are becoming missed opportunities for them. And it's starting to look a little bit like the Spurs stories we've seen in the past.
Yeah. These results, I mean, you know how high everybody who listens to this show and reads our site knows how high I am on Pochettino, and felt that he would be the guy to fix Spurs syndrome, as I call it. And he's fixing it, but it hasn't. This is the sort of result which just is a Spurs result, right? There's no other way to characterize it. This is the kind of game they jumped out ahead at West Brom and they gave up an equalizer and didn't really push for a winner. They need another striker to supplement Kane. Obviously, Son, a player that I heard a lot about this week because I was at Leverkusen, of course. Son and Clinton as signings are kind of supplementary players, but they're not out-and-out strikers. They're good players, Son especially, very good player, but not a guy you can deploy up front. So they need another striker. They didn't get Berahino. Berahino was looking very despondent on the bench in this match. The interesting thing about Pochettino is, though, there's so much respect for the job he's done still. I saw in one of Gary Neville's interviews when he took the Valencia job, he said, the manager I'm most emulating, the guy I most like right now is Pochettino. That's the way I'm going to manage at Valencia, which I thought was very interesting that he picked Pochettino and he picked the Spurs manager. But I think he was trying to pick a guy who was a former player like him, young. But
maybe somebody who had also managed in La Liga before.
Well, that's true too, right? But there's a lot of respect for Pochettino, but Spurs have a historical vice on them when they have matches like this. And yes, now they're unbeaten in 14, but about half those games were draws. So you're not going to win the league by drawing every other game. And I think that this is a problem, particularly despite the Liverpool result this week. With Klopp at Liverpool, my thought that Spurs are definitely in the top four is now wobbling. I still think they get there and Liverpool finishes fifth, but Klopp is getting 3 points in some places where they shouldn't get 3 points, and Tottenham doesn't have any of those results this year.
One more team that we want to talk about at the top of the table before shifting our focus to the relegation battle. Arsenal, in addition to Leicester, was the only team this week at the top of the table to get 3 points. 3-1 victory, good result. I came away a little bit concerned about Arsenal's defense. A couple of chances in this game for the Black Cats that really should have been converted. This game should have been closer than the final score was.
Yeah, this goes back to the argument, Richard. Arsenal that much better because they got Petr Cech? Maybe, because I think Sunderland certainly gets a 2-1 lead at some point early in that second half if there's another keeper. He made some very good saves. He controlled kind of he communicated well with the back line. Sunderland were all over them for about 15 minutes to open the second half. Or is Cech just kind of masking other things and the results that they normally drop, the games they drop, they're going to drop anyway? So that's the question. Was Petr Cech a 8 to 10 point boost signing? And if it is, Arsenal might win the league. And if it's not, then they're going to finish third or fourth like they always do, because I don't see anything different in this team, unfortunately. I Mesut Ozil is having a fantastic season. Beyond that, I'm not sure Arsenal is better, other than maybe Bellerin and Monreal have come good at the fullback positions. But in the midfield, up top, I don't see any difference between this and previous Arsenal teams, with the exception of Ozil having a really good season.
Yeah, Ozil, that ball for Campbell to put in the perfect spot to keep it away from the keeper and allow that goal. That was a great ball. Subtly, I think we're getting a little bit too used to Mesut Ozil being amazing this season. Let's go ahead and shift our focus, as promised, to the bottom of the table, a relegation battle that has become much more interesting in recent weeks. Over the first couple months of the season, we saw the same three teams in those bottom three spots and started to give up on Sunderland, Newcastle, and Aston Villa. And although those three teams are the ones that still occupy the relegation spots in the Premier League, there's a little bit more hope for two of those teams. But Kartik, let's start with the one that seems mired in the bottom three, and I think we'd be a little bit surprised if they claw their way out of it at this point. Aston Villa got a 1-1 result at Southampton this weekend, their sixth point of the season. Tell me what your current thoughts are on Remy Gard's team. Do you see them making progress?
It depends. I guess it's relative. Yeah, I see them making progress. They were able to withstand a flurry, which should have had Southampton up 3 or 4 nil in the first 20 or 25 minutes, get a goal, kind of a poacher's goal from a central defender, Julian Lescott, which was good to see. And then they let Romeo come in and get that equalizer, but they held on for the point.
Some amazing corner kick defending in this game.
Yeah, so I think maybe we're seeing some grittiness and some resourcefulness, but they have 6 points through 15 games, which means realistically they're going to have to get 23 matches left. They're going to have to get about 32 points. I just don't. They're going to have to average a point and a half or almost a point and a half a game. You just don't see it with this team.
Yeah, that would just be an incredible turnaround. And you alluded to the beginning of this game. I think the one thing that was so distressing for me is you still see the effort with Villa's players. It's just player for player. They're just not as good. And Sunderland kind of lost their focus and lost their intensity and allowed Villa to get back into the game. Poor corner kick defending before halftime gave Villa the lead. And Southampton wasn't able to get 3 points from this one. I don't know if there's enough in the cupboard really for Remy Gard here. When you see them go up against a Southampton team that's struggling so much, I think Southampton is down to 13th in league at this point, and they looked so second best over that first 20 or 25 minutes. It's really discouraging, and I think that's partly what maybe separates them from Newcastle and Sunderland. Let's talk about Newcastle first, because they did have a good result this weekend. Kartik, the inconsistency of this team, I did not see this result coming.
No, I didn't either. I thought it would be, in fact, the opposite. And I've said all along, people who listen to the show know this, that Newcastle wasn't going to be in trouble. They were going to get out of trouble. McLaren is a good tactical manager and a good, and they have a good enough squad. Now, of course, what people have talked about in the last 2 weeks is that McLaren might be a good tactical manager, but he's not a good man manager. Hmm. He's not a good a coach, right? I mean, he's a good coach. He's not a good manager. However you would describe that. He's not good dealing with personalities, and that's gotten him everywhere he's been, and it's only been at places like Twente or Middlesbrough where they haven't had personalities and huge egos in the dressing room that he's been successful at. But Forest and Derby and Wolfsburg, and now at Newcastle and England, he's had all these problems. So that's a good point, but somehow he got them up for this game. He got them up for it, and maybe it's just Liverpool and the Klopp aspect. Maybe the players got up themselves, but this was a pretty tidy performance from Newcastle. I thought even before they got that first goal that they were the better side, and part of it was Benteke is kind of an immobile player up front, and Klopp can't necessarily do all the things he wants to do with Benteke up front. Lallana didn't get the start. I thought was pretty good today. He was one Liverpool player that stood out as playing well for me, but there were. This wasn't the best Liverpool performance, and Newcastle for the first time showed a lot of fight in a while. Sissoko in particular, I think he's the guy that defines Newcastle, right? Because when he's really good, you think he's one of the top 20 or 25 players in this league and could get a transfer to a big club or maybe even back to a big club in France. And then when he's off, he's terrible. And today he was very good.
Hmm. It's that inconsistency that you kind of highlighted with Newcastle that we're talking about, it seems in contrast to what we see from their rival Sunderland now, that seem to have achieved a certain level of performance under Sam Allardyce, even if that level of performance didn't produce a result this weekend. But even in that game, you could see that this is a team that at least has some kind of framework in place. They're pretty consistently going with three central defenders now. They've got Jan and Villa doing a good job in that, although he didn't really close down Mesut Ozil on that pass that we referred to earlier. Even though they lost by 2 goals this weekend, Kartik, I think Black Cat supporters have a lot of reason to believe that the Sam Allardyce effect is going to carry them to safety.
Well, this is why you hire a manager like Allardyce. You have managers who complain that they inherit personnel and they try and force personnel to play their style of football, right? Allardyce hasn't played this 3-5-2 or 5-3-2 much in his career. No. This is not the Allardyce style. He just found the kind of club he had, the kind of personnel he had, and adapted to it. And this is actually, this formation has made Jan and Villa, who is kind of the crown jewel transfer they've had recently. If you follow his career, he's a guy who I think a lot of people thought would be on Arsenal or Chelsea or a club like that at this point, or PSG. This formation, maybe not in this game as much, but in other games, the Crystal Palace game, for example, 2 weeks ago, has allowed him to dictate the tempo and pace of that midfield and how they play, and he's been very good. This is another example why I think Allardyce is really an underrated manager, and they're going to stay up. I mean, I thought that they were pretty good for 60 minutes in this game, and this is the problem with Arsenal, right? There are a lot of games that they're winning, even the game against Watford a couple weeks ago, where we're saying the team that they should dispose of easily was pretty good for 60 or 65 minutes. Mm-hmm. This is a recurring theme with Arsenal also. So at some point, you want to see Arsenal just come out and take a game to the opposition, and they don't do that very often anymore.
Hmm. Regarding Sunderland, the one thing that I'm a little bit worried about, I guess you touched on Mvia, so it'd be good to get your comments on this, is this weekend they started him with Toivonen in the middle, and it looked pretty weak. At least it looked like one man was trying to trying to lock down the middle by himself. And it puts him in a situation where he kind of has to be Etienne Capoue, it seems like. And Capoue has had such success this year, has been one of the better players at his positions in the league. But it also seems like a very high bar to set for somebody. Putting Mvia in a position where he really needs to be one of the best midfielders in the league for them to have success. And maybe that's possible, Kartik, but I also think that people might be a little bit right to worry about that, considering this is Mvia's first year in the Premier League.
Yeah, and he's shown the flashes in the previous games, but he wasn't quite as good in this game. And so that is one concern. I think another concern is just the inconsistency of their strikers. They have, if you look on paper, between Fletcher and Defoe and Jermaine Lands and Barini, they have really a good striker core. But they, none of these guys can consistently score goals anymore. So it's a dilemma for Allardyce who to pick for each game. And he's going to have to get some sort of performance lightning in the bottle out of one of those guys. Obviously, Barini kind of did it for them 2 years ago when he was on loan from Liverpool. So maybe he's the guy. Or Defoe, we know, can poach goals. But one of those four guys I mentioned are going to really have to step up. I think one of them will. I just can't tell you which one it is. Maybe most likely Barini would be the most likely of those four.
Or maybe it might end up being Duncan Watmore, who has been kind of a...
Well, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, between him and DeAndre Yedlin, a couple of young players, seemingly embracing spots in Big Sam's first 11. Let's talk about another of the big surprise results for the week of the weekend, Kartik. Although Chelsea losing at this point is not that big of a surprise. They've lost four of their last seven at Stamford Bridge. But this was such a great 3 points for Bournemouth for the same reason that the last two results that they've gotten were great results. They do not have a team right now that is very healthy. They've lost so many key players. But to be able to bring somebody like Glenn Murray off the bench, get that goal, get 3 points at Stamford Bridge, it's starting to give me some reason to think that Eddie Howe's underlying philosophy maybe rode out this troublesome period of time, and now they've got some new life.
Yeah, if they can get some points over the Christmas period, they're going to need to get to about 20 points, 22 points maybe by that the end of that period, and then see if they can get to 25 points or so before Callum Wilson and Max Gradle return in February. Maybe it'll be early March. But if they can get to 25, Leicester was at 22 when they made their run last season. I could see Bournemouth, if they were 25, 26 points when those two guys come back, staying up. They just need to get some more results like this one. This was a great result. Gets them to 13 points, gets them within kind of a breathing room of within sight of that 20-point mark, I'm saying, at the end of December. Because they will stay up if they get those guys back fit. And they're in a position to stay up. They lost people who didn't get to see the players that they lost early this season. Bournemouth looked like a team, quite frankly, Richard, in spite of that loss to Villa in the first match of the season, that now looks like a completely abnormal result. They look like a team that once they figured out the Premier League would finish 13th or 14th and be fine. Mm-hmm. And the way they were playing football and the number of chances they were creating, the number of chances they were creating early in matches, especially, you know, what you see with smaller teams is they often sit back, or even if they're trying to play football, they don't create chances until early in the second half or late in the first half. Bournemouth were all over some teams early in the season, even when they weren't getting results. This game, same thing. They created so many chances from minute 10 to about 25 until Chelsea kind of took the game back over at that point. But they got their just rewards at the end of the match, getting that goal from Glenn Murray, even though it does appear he was offside.
Yeah, it was pretty clear. But in those situations where the keeper bolts off the line, it seems like everybody in the officials get confused.
Well, I should mention Bournemouth has. I don't want to get into this the idea of looking at an alternate table, but Bournemouth was denied a clear goal, and then Liverpool got a goal that shouldn't have stood in that game, and then against Swansea got a goal which was clearly offside to draw that game. So they've been denied 3 or 4 points already on poor calls. So this might be just, again, another correction.
Yeah, and I hate looking at stuff like that. 90-minute matches, they're about the challenges that are presented to you. Chelsea had an unfortunate challenge presented to them, but you have to overcome those challenges, and if you can't, well, these are the results that you get. We have a couple of...
Which I should say, some managers embrace, because Gary Monk, to his credit, he's under a lot of fire, Richard. We should mention this. We already talked about this game. He said, okay, there's controversy over the first two Leicester goals, but we were second best. We were badly beaten anyway. because as you know, Leicester could have scored 6 or 7 goals in that game. So he didn't use the officiating as an excuse, and I like seeing that.
Yeah. On the other hand, Jose Mourinho continuing to find more trouble with Chelsea's results. We're going to take a break right now. We have a couple other teams of concern that we're going to address when we come back after the break. Norwich is now very close to the bottom, and Swansea continues to find themselves relegation embattled. But stick with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. Welcome back, everybody. It's time to go to Spain, where perhaps the biggest non-FIFA news of the week took place. While Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid took care of business on Saturday, beating Granada and Getafe, Barcelona dropped points for only the third time this season, drawing 1-1 at Valencia. That would normally be the story, but instead, we have Gary Neville. On Monday, Valencia officially parted ways with Nuno Espirito Santo, the man who guided Los Che back into Champions League last season. In his place, owner Peter Lim has brought in Neville, a man not only respected for his playing career at Manchester United and his amazing punditry on Sky Sports, but is also a business partner of Lim. Lim owns 50% of Salford City FC, the club Neville and Manchester United's Class of 92 have invested in, as well as a few hotel and entertainment properties around Manchester. Neville wasn't on the sidelines on Saturday, but he was in the stands at the Mestalla, and he takes over Los Che for this week's Champions League match against Leon. Kartik, you wrote about the Neville appointment on the site. What are your thoughts?
Well, that first game against Leon is massive. Talk about being thrown in on the deep end. That's a game that Valencia has to win to keep going in Champions League, depending on other results, right? I mean, there are scenarios where they could get in.
They need to have a better result than Ghent, basically.
Right, you're right. So there's a scenario where they could draw and Ghent loses. But Ghent is at home, so they're probably going to need to win and hope that Ghent drops points to
Zenit, who are perfect so far.
Points, right. Yeah, but don't have any real incentive in this game, although Andre Villas-Boas is moving on after the group stage of the Champions League.
That's true.
Yeah, so this might be just a farewell game for the manager, at least in Europe. So
good old Russia.
Yes. So that's the that's a big game. But I think what this is going to do is it's going to give an English manager some experience managing a different style of football, different types of players, and also create a context to which maybe more British managers will move abroad, more British players maybe will even move abroad. There will be a renewed focus on the rest of La Liga now in England. Currently, people just look at Barcelona and Real Madrid. They look at Barcelona because they're Barcelona. They look at Real Madrid because Gareth Bale is there and Rafa Benitez is there now, and Cristiano. So they don't always look at Real Madrid in Britain, is why I mention it. Barcelona has a loyal following, a strong following in the UK. No other Spanish club does. So this will put some more focus on La Liga and maybe some more appreciation in Britain about the deficiencies of the Premier League, the deficiencies of English players and English managers. At the same time, it also could create a situation where England produces a manager that now has this kind of high-level experience, because Valencia is a big club, and a guy that might be ready to take over the England job. My favorite is Eddie Howe. I would love to see him manage England, but I'm realistic in knowing that the FA is probably not going to go in that direction. So this gives Gary Neville in England a shot.
It probably shouldn't be understated how shocking this news was, although 3 or 4 days later kind of makes sense, particularly with the business connection and the long-time connection between Lim and Neville. It still came out of nowhere, and it's going to be very interesting to see what Sky Sports does.
And it came right after the bookies had slashed the odds on Neville becoming the manager at Fulham, interestingly enough.
That is very interesting. I'm going to be interested to see what Sky Sports does. Gary Neville had become a very quick icon with his punditry, and it'll be very interesting to see if
they don't have another guy like him.
Nobody does. I think we're going to miss that. Players of the week, Kartik, I'll go ahead and go first, where I had one of Saturday's heroes locked into the spot before we saw what happened on Sunday, and I'm going to go with Jorginho Wijnaldum, creating both of those goals against a very difficult opponent, giving Newcastle a much-needed 3 points, and reminding us of some of the spark that he brought over during his first matches of the season. He was the Eredivisie's Player of the Year last year, obviously a very talented player, and did the biggest part this weekend in delivering Newcastle a crucial win. He's my player of the week. Kartik?
It'd be so easy to just go with Mahrez, but you could pick Mahrez every week, right? So I'm going to go with Bojan. Bojan was amazing this week. We know how good he is when he's fit. And this is, again, about a guy finding his level. I mean, I've heard so many derogatory comments about the player from fans of Milan and fans of Roma and Barca fans who thought he was going to be Messi's sidekick, because it certainly seemed that way the first year or year and a half Bojan was in the team, and they had just bought Pedro, and it looked like that was going to be the front line. Messi, once Pep started playing Messi up front, Bojan on one flank, Pedro on the other, it didn't work out that way, right? I mean, it did for Pedro for a while, and then obviously once they bought Neymar, Pedro's days were, his shelf life was limited. He's now in the Premier League also. But Bojan then bounced around a bit. He's still only 24 or 25. We forget this because we've been following Bojan for a decade now. But he looks so good in this game. His movement was so fluid. His connections with Shaqiri. Now, Shaqiri is a player that we've been waiting to see this, right? And we thought, well, maybe Shaqiri's a guy that peaked too early. Maybe that year he had under Heinkens at Bayern before it began to go bad, maybe that was an aberration. Maybe it was because he was 20 or 21. He's not that level player. This game, he was so good. He was a 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10, and so was Bojan. And Bojan on the ball, his vision, his link-up play, fantastic. Just quick note, I want to mention Jeff Cameron was in the midfield for Stoke in this game, the American international who never plays in the midfield for the United States, and he looked pretty good in that midfield. Now, of course, when you're playing with Shaqiri and Bojan in the same midfield, you probably will look good. He doesn't have that level player to play with the United States, but another consideration for Jurgen Klinsmann. And that game and the Mönchengladbach game give him a lot to think about.
Kartik, let's get to some user feedback from Twitter. Robert, Sunny SoCal Rob 25, asks us about the League Cup. Four teams remaining. Everton is going to be taking on Manchester City. Stoke is going to be taking on Liverpool. Which teams are going to be taking this competition most seriously, Kartik?
I would say Everton would be taking it the most seriously of the four because they've got this long run without a trophy. They haven't won a trophy since Paul Rideout's famous goal. To beat Manchester United in 1995.
They've never won the League Cup, remarkably.
And they've never won the League Cup. And they've been to semifinals and finals, a lot of cup competitions recently. But there's something about this competition, which Manuel Pellegrini seems to embrace for some reason. I mean, when Roberto Mancini was the manager, this was a chance to bloodlet all the young players. So Pellegrini hasn't done that, which I should have mentioned in the Manchester City section is part of the reason Manchester City's in this position now. Pellegrini complained about the fatigue of the team, but he didn't need to trot out all his first teamers against Hull. Let's be honest. And he didn't have to do it in previous League Cup games against lower division opposition, but he did. So maybe he's the manager taking it the most seriously. Ultimately, though, Stoke is playing the best football of the four teams that are left, and we're a month out, but they would be my pick to win the League Cup right now.
Yeah, I guess I'll go with Liverpool. I think that it's very unlikely that Klopp changes his approach to where at this point he has rotated his squad, but he's taken all the games pretty seriously. And I think that'll continue in the next in January. If it does continue, I think they're probably the team best equipped.
It's a great Final Four, though. We have a lower division team that seeps in, or a team that doesn't really care about the competition. This time, I think we've got four teams that are going to take it pretty seriously, and four teams, all of which we could see winning this cup.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are going to be hoping for that Everton-Liverpool final. Kartik, let's jump back into the relegation race. Let's talk about Norwich. This is a team that I think we were all high on at the beginning of the season, and for me, I still harbor hopes that they're going to get everything going. I respect Alex Neil as a manager. A lot of players on this team I like a lot, but the results speak for themselves. 2-0 loss at Watford this weekend perhaps isn't shocking, but the shocking part is, after a series of bad results, they're now even with Newcastle in 18th place. Obviously not where they want to be. So what's going on with Norwich? Why has this collection of players that we really thought was going to succeed climbing back up from the Championship failed to find success so far?
Gosh, I don't know, because the games I've watched, even when they're not getting results, they're playing pretty well, right? They're just not finishing chances. Defensively, there are one or two errors in games that are costing them. It's tough to put your finger on with Norwich, other than to say maybe they're limited finishing. And this is what did them in two seasons ago when they got relegated. That team under Chris Hughton wasn't that bad. It was just that they had brought in Gary Hooper and they had brought in why am I forgetting his name? Who from Holland? Who went to France after
Van Wolfswinkel?
Yeah, Van Wolfswinkel, who couldn't do anything, and it was one of these things where on the balance of play, they did not look like a bottom three side or anything approaching it, but they just couldn't score goals. And now we're seeing the same thing, even with Alex Neil's team, with a different striker in Cameron Jerome, and the different types of formations they played. So they're going through a rough patch, but ultimately their survival might hinge on Bournemouth getting their players fit and on Newcastle showing some degree of consistency, because I think we all have Villa penciled in for, or maybe not penciled in now, maybe it's in ink, for one of the relegation spots. I think Sunderland will get out because of Allardyce, but those other two, if Bournemouth doesn't get their guys fit and Newcastle doesn't show any consistency in spite of today's result, those are probably the next two teams. Hmm. So maybe Norwich just escapes.
You kind of alluded to this when referring to Bournemouth. It seems like every year with the relegation battle, one or two teams' fortunes are defined by one or two good months. Leicester is obviously the example. Last year, we can remember some of the great escapes from the past. Those teams just finding a way to click towards the end of the season to survive. And Norwich seems like that type of team to me, Kartik. And maybe that's me continuing to fall back on this feeling we've all had that this collection of players is actually pretty good. And it's easy for me to see this collection of players having a good run of games in March and April just by maintaining faith, maintaining consistency, and putting that together. At the same time, that seems a little bit intellectually dishonest for me. It seems like it's just another way for me to not admit I was wrong about them.
No, but there's something there, though, because Christopher Harris and I, the gaffer, got to sit with Franco Di Santo at Schalke last week when we were in Germany, and he was part of multiple relegation fights and he mentioned to us, and I don't have the direct quote, but something along the lines of that one season where they came from behind and beat Arsenal, and they had to get like 7 or 8 wins out of 11 matches, and they did it, that essentially they knew they had been playing below their ability all season, and once they came back to beat a big team, it clicked, and they got out. They finished 13th or 14th that year. So there's something to that. That teams we say, like last year with Leicester.
Yes.
At the beginning of the season, I sat, and I would rather people not look at my picks from the beginning of last season, because I said Leicester were going to finish 10th or 11th in the league, and they sat 20th for three quarters of the season. It made me look like a complete idiot. But something clicked. Obviously, Nigel Pearson gets a lot of credit for that, but they always had the squad to get out. And now we're seeing that same squad with one or two additions at the top of the Premier League. So I don't think our read on Norwich was necessarily wrong. I mean, the Leicester example proves to me that sometimes our instincts, when people like you and I look at squads, tends to be accurate.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about another team that, on paper, has a squad that should not be in this position, Swansea. How they've gotten to this point is remarkable, and I think is defying explanation, at least in the moment, because when you look player for player, they have a pretty good team. But a 3-0 loss at home to Leicester, this momentum that seems to be anchoring them to the bottom of the table, and now they're only 1 point above the drop. What's your theory as to what's going on with Gary Monk's team?
I'm out of theories now. I part of it was the selfish play of John Joe Shelvey. Maybe the health issues with Key and some other players, but the guys that need to now, Jefferson Montero is back, and that's not giving them the boost you would want to see at the back. They're making the kind of critical errors that they haven't made in previous seasons. You wonder a little bit about the sale of Ben Davies to Spurs, a sale that was kind of a luxury buy for Spurs. Spurs did that for a couple of years, right? They were buying backup players in a lot of positions. And maybe he's better than Neil Taylor. Maybe he'd be a better left back, because a lot of the play that's coming up against them, we saw it with Mahrez this week, is coming from that side of the field. And I just don't know that Taylor, I'm not even sure if Ashley Williams is reading the game as well as he used to. Hmm. That having been said, they're not scoring goals either, right, in some of these games. So going forward, it's tough to say, because there's this history with Swansea of guys like Sinclair and Borini and Boné. We saw it again with Boné now. I'm hearing from Man City fans, hey, why don't we just start Iñaccio when Aguero's out? Because even though he's 18, he gives us more than Boné does. This long history of guys who have left Joe Allen, although he had a pretty good game today, guys who've left Swansea and not replicated their performances elsewhere. Hmm. But what's happened when those guys were sold previously is the guys that Swansea would replace them with would replicate the performances of those guys. That's not happening anymore. So that is one of the unbelievable things right now about the Swans, and I'm not quite sure where Gary Monk goes from here.
Last break coming up, everybody. When we come back, we're going to update you on Germany, talk to Kartik a little bit about his time at Bayer and Schalke. We're going to get our top fours in place, talk about the teams that we haven't touched on nearing relegation, West Brom, Stoke, a little bit safer now, but also talk about Southampton. And then we'll also look forward to the games coming up in midweek. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Well, there's shock and awe in the Bundesliga this weekend as Bayern Munich finally lost a match. They'd fallen one other time this season, that game Arsenal took from them in the second half of the Emirates. And again on Saturday, it was the second half that was their undoing. Three goals in a 14-minute span from Borussia Mönchengladbach, the third by thriving U.S. international Fabian Johnson, had Andre Schubert's team up three in a route to a 3-1 win over the Bundesliga leaders, who now have a 5-point lead on Borussia Mönchengladbach. Schubert probably deserves a thought or two here. When he took over for Lucien Favre after five games, Gladbach was last in the league. They didn't have a point, and they were kind of searching for answers because they didn't want Favre to leave. But he insisted on leaving, vaulting Schubert to the coach's role, and the team hasn't dropped a league game since. In fact, their only loss was a 2-1 home defeat to Manchester City in Champions League. A pretty remarkable outlier considering they've played Juventus twice since then. They're now third in the Bundesliga, and they may be the most dangerous team about to drop from Champions League to Europa League, and they've become one of Europe's feel-good stories again. Kartik, all of that leads me to a question I want to ask you to put this in perspective. Neutral field, the game is tomorrow. How many teams do you think in Europe could actually beat Gladbach at this point?
Barcelona, and that's it. Juventus had two shots and they didn't. Mm-hmm. Manchester City, by the way, that game is not only an outlier. That is the first time Pellegrini in his tenure has admitted that Manchester City had been outplayed in a game they won.
Wow.
So Richard Gladbach took the game to City. City very resourcefully got the goals they needed in the second half to come from behind. Gladbach didn't get the second goal when they were up 1-0, and they should have. They were all over City. But I watched this game, and Mönchengladbach in the second half, their movement was so precise. Now, granted, we should mention Bayern are dealing with a lot of injuries currently. Well, just like everybody, it seems like we're talking about, have a lot of injuries. But they've been opened up at the back now often in Bundesliga without conceding a lot of goals. But this game, once the dam opened, it flooded out. And what we saw from Fabian Johnson, this is of interest to our American listeners, was a player, and we've seen this over the last couple of weeks, a player that is running riot, coming in from a wide position on the right side with Mönchengladbach, kind of floating, going forward, not having the defensive responsibilities he does with the United States, and scoring goals. He scored four or five goals now in the last couple of weeks between Europe and the league, and he was involved in all the build-up play here for Mönchengladbach yesterday. The thing I would note is, of course, he plays often on the back line for the United States because the United States doesn't have good defenders. So Cameron, who we mentioned, was very good in the midfield, linking up with Bojan at Shaqiri at Stoke, and then Fabian Johnson, who's on a tear right now with Mönchengladbach, end up playing on the back line for the United States because the United States does not have good defenders.
I would say Johnson is playing as well as any European American since Dempsey was at Fulham, which is as good as any American has ever played in Europe. So I think that we're probably not talking about Fabian Johnson enough.
Yeah, I would say since maybe Claudio Reyna had one really incredible season at Wolfsburg, which got him a transfer to Rangers, but Leverkusen owned him. It's complicated, and they sold him in the middle of his loan period at Wolfsburg. But to cash in on him. But yeah, this is about as well as anyone has played in a long period of time. There were games, there were stretches when John O'Brien was fit at Ajax where he played really well. DeMarcus Beasley had a stretch at PSV where he was playing very, very well.
Donovan at Everton.
That was a loan period.
So very short period of time.
Yeah, but he did play very, very well in one of those two loan periods. But this is a remarkable run for an American player in Europe, and it's giving some optimism around the pool, because we've mentioned Cameron a couple times in the show. You mentioned DeAndre Yedlin earlier. I am impressed that he's adjusted to, even though he got beat on Campbell's goal, that had to do with Ozil's ball.
Yeah, but he got hung out to dry a little bit there, but he should have done better. He got hung out to dry.
He should have done better, but he's adapted to Big Sam, and he was not going to play, it seemed, at all under Advocaat, but going to this deployment of wingbacks under Allardyce has gotten Yedlin some calls above Billy Jones at that left back, right back, or right wing back position. So It's now beginning to work for Americans. John Brooks had a goal I saw against Leverkusen yesterday. So first goal for Hertha all season off of corners. Things are beginning to work out for the Americans that are over there. Alfredo Morales, I should point out, has played pretty well for Ingolstadt also. Mm. Now, does this mean that we're going to see more Americans finally go to Europe at the end of the season? I want to see Darlington Nagby in Europe next season. I'm going to say that right now. I know people in Portland where you are, Richard, are in love with the guy. I think he's that next level player that the U.S. needs to jump to a club like that and develop the skill set that he doesn't have right now.
He needs to push himself a little bit too. I want to see Bilhamid in Europe because the U.S.
Yeah, that's another one.
The U.S. needs a goalkeeper pretty badly at this point. Kartik, weekly tradition, our top fours. You're up.
Okay, let's go. Okay, so on form, one Leicester, two.
After this weekend, there is no form.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know that I want to put Arsenal back in there because they lost last week. So two, maybe we go Everton because they haven't played yet this week. Two Everton, three. Manchester United gets results, right? They keep getting draws, so maybe they just work it out there. And same thing with Spurs. They keep getting draws. So that's 3-4. So end of the season. Whew, this is tough. I guess I'm going to go one Manchester City for one more week, two with a caveat. If Van Gaal finally gets it figured out, United should win the title this year. Two Manchester United, three Arsenal, four Spurs, with Liverpool really knocking on the door and me beginning to entertain the thought that Leicester might be in that top four at the end of the season. I think then there's a drop off after the two other teams I mentioned, Liverpool and Leicester.
Yeah, our top fours are very, very similar. In form, I have Leicester, Spurs, United, Everton, the same four, just kind of in different order. And who cares about form after this weekend? As far as end of the season, I think this might be the same way you're looking at it, Kartik. I'm looking at how these scenarios are likely to play out. And I'm following a lot back on what we've seen these teams do over the last few seasons under these managers, how we see them playing this year. And that's why United keeps coming up for me and you, because out of all the things that we've seen transpire with the way that these teams have been managed over the last few years, Van Gaal getting this team to play better from, say, February to April seems like one of the most viable scenarios at this point. I'm going with City 1, but for the first time in a long time, I have Manchester United number 2. Arsenal number 3, and I have Liverpool number 4, because I find it a little bit easier to believe that Jurgen Klopp is going to make up those points rather than Spurs. Okay, Kartik, we have another piece of feedback. This is again from Robert from Twitter. He's asking us about next week's fixtures, where Leicester play, his word, scrappy Chelsea. We keep coming back to Chelsea. We haven't talked about Chelsea very much in this podcast because they're just out of that relegation debate. But at this point, I have no reason to believe Chelsea is going to beat Leicester.
You know what? Before this weekend, I thought, okay, that's one of these correction games. I told you about the 7-game stretch. I was thinking of Leicester. And, okay, Chelsea, they're beginning to get around it. They're beginning to build something again. And that's a game they'll win, and Leicester, the wheels will come off. But now, after watching both their performances on Saturday, I'm thinking that the form table doesn't – and it's not even the form table. It's the actual table. It doesn't lie at this point. Leicester is that much better than Chelsea. They're not going to be able to defend Mahrez out wide. Drinkwater has controlled that midfield. Drinkwater is an interesting player because he was one of the guys that – maybe the only guy that's a core player on this team that's returning that wasn't really a favorite of Pearson's. Didn't play that much under Pearson, right? He was a guy now that has really embraced Ranieri's management and the role he's been given under Claudio Ranieri. And then there's also the reality that nothing would satisfy Claudio Ranieri, who has gotten everything right this season, more than beating Jose Mourinho, who has spent a decade deriding him in the media in various countries, whether it be here in England or in Italy. He's made references to him in Spain, even though Ranieri wasn't managing there at the time. So I think Ranieri will probably beat Mourinho. I would have said something completely different 3 days ago.
I look at these two squads right now. I look at Leicester. There's only one player in Leicester that I think is playing below average, below the Premier League average player, which is a pretty high standard, and that's Wes Morgan. I think he's a good player, but I think he's a little bit below average for the league. For Chelsea, I think there's only one player that's playing above average for all the talents that they have. The only player that I can rely on that team is Willian. That's it. And so when you talk about how these players have played now for 4 months, I just don't see it. You saw Chelsea play Bournemouth this weekend. They were so much slower, had so much less intensity, let a completely depleted Bournemouth team stay in that game. It was depressing. It was depressing for somebody that
right.
knows
Cesc
that
Fabregas this person... Cesc Fabregas is one of the worst players in the league, mm-hmm. full stop. Not just one of the worst players on a big club. He doesn't move well. He's always losing his mark. He's giving the ball away a lot now. And then I look at Chelsea's back line. They're just a mess. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with Hazard either. He's showing some yeah. fight, some spark, but the end product isn't there. And then you look at Leicester. Everybody is hitting on all cylinders with that team. And we thought that Gorkhan Inler would be a core player, right? That would be the guy that would maybe lift them out of a relegation fight. Instead, he's very much on the fringes of a team that's leading the Premier League.
Kartik, one game we haven't touched on because neither team is involved in the relegation battle. It's probably the game that deserves to have the least said about it. Manchester United, West Ham, we probably would have gotten really, really short odds on betting a 0-0 before this one. It ended 0-0. I'm going to go back to a hot take here. I don't see what Manchester United loses at this point by changing managers. I don't see the team of this talent regressing. Because what are they regressing from at this point? At the same time, I see a team that's lacking energy, that's lacking initiative, and lacking desire, that could probably do something with a change of voice. And the only thing that kind of tempers my opinion on this is the knowledge that Louis van Gaal does tend to do better in that second half of the season. But he also has this part of him that tends to flame out in the second half of the season. I'm starting to question more and more what's going to happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about this. In fact, John Cross from The Mirror said on a program I was watching the other night that he thinks Van Gaal is more likely to be sacked in season this season now than Jose Mourinho, that Chelsea has made the decision for whatever reason they're just going to ride it out with Mourinho. Maybe it's contractual. Maybe it's about the supporters there who've all taken on Mourinho's personality.
Well, all their players are bad too, and Manchester United's right. players aren't bad. You watch.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Right.
You watch Martial play. You watch Mata play. You watch Schweinsteiger and Schneiderlin and Smalling and De Gea. These are good players that should be contending for a title. And in fairness, they're contending for a title. It's just impossible for me to imagine that this team would be worse under another manager that Manchester United could reasonably get.
Right. So Cross says basically if he doesn't beat Wolfsburg, he's in trouble. Wolfsburg in the Champions League this week away at the Volkswagen Arena because
he should be sacked for that. I mean,
he should be sacked because it was an easy Champions League group. And the feeling is with the Premier League having this much trouble at the top of the table with all the injuries Arsenal and Manchester City have had that Manchester United should have pulled away from them and they haven't. So that's the general sense among the punditry in England and the general sense among people close to Manchester United. So he very well might get sacked. You're not just throwing something out there. I know some of our listeners may find it hard to believe, but there are actual journalists in England saying the same thing Richard's saying, that there is a very strong possibility that if he doesn't beat Wolfsburg and they're still sitting third, fourth in the Premier League, even if they're only a couple points behind Arsenal and Man City, and maybe Leicester will still be up there middle of January, that he'll be gone.
And I am still hearing whispers, and I don't know much about how the power structure of Manchester United works. I don't know whose voices are strongest there, but I'm still hearing whispers from people that know that there are people at Manchester United that are direly disappointed in how the team is playing. Now, whether those voices are the ones that are eventually going to make the decision or influence the decision, I don't know. But the feelings that fans have around Old Trafford are being replicated at some level within Manchester United's hierarchy. Quickly, Everton versus Crystal Palace tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to this game. It does seem like a game that Everton has been losing lately, particularly with Crystal Palace's ability to sit back, play without the ball, and still control a game that way.
Yeah, again, this is something we've talked about time and again on this show, that Pardew's teams go through these cycles of being down and up, and that happened at Newcastle consistently, happened at Palace since he took over. Assuming that 5-1 win over Newcastle was an outlier, they're now back on one of those upswings, so I would expect them to win this match.
Midweek Champions League on Tuesday, Manchester City versus Borussia Mönchengladbach. City can still take first place, but they have very little to play for there. Wolfsburg versus Manchester United. Wolfsburg win that game. They could put Manchester United into Europa League. Wolfsburg lost at home this weekend to Borussia Mönchengladbach. On Wednesday, Chelsea versus Porto. Chelsea has not secured their place in the knockout round there, but the big game that everybody is looking forward to amidst this sea of uncertainties for the Premier League is Arsenal's visit to Olympiacos. Kartik, I'm not going to pretend like I'm an Olympiacos expert based on what we've seen in Europe over the last couple years. They certainly seem like a capable team. Certainly, if history is any indication, capable of tripping up Arsenal. I don't know where I would put my money on this one, though. I think this is why I'm not a betting man. I don't have a good feel for this game. I'm not going to be surprised by any result.
No, nor am I. I could very easily see Arsenal winning 4-1 and advancing, or I could see Olympiacos gutting out a 1-1 draw, or actually a 1-0 Arsenal win will not put Arsenal through. So yes. I could see that result too. So these two teams have played a lot in Champions League. For some reason, they're always in the same group. We see these patterns with teams always being grouped together in Champions League over and over again. Manchester City's been in Bayern Munich's group three times in four years. So this is a familiar matchup for Arsenal. But still, I don't know what to say. I think maybe slight edge to Olympiacos simply because they're at home and they can get out of there with a draw in advance, or even one goal loss in advance.
I can completely see that. I would like to see Arsenal just putting it all together and playing to their talent level. But in a big game where everything's on the line, when was the last time Arsenal actually did that? We see them win first or play well in first game legs at home against Bayern or Barcelona, and then go on the road and not seize that potential. I don't know.
Well, we even saw it in the FA Cup final against Hull a couple of years ago when they fell back behind 2-0 and were very fortunate to get the extra time and won in extra time. And last year, yes, they took Villa out early in the FA Cup final, but remember they were very fortunate to get past Wigan or Reading or whoever, Reading in the semifinals. It was Wigan the previous year they were fortunate to get by. So
and they gave Birmingham City that cup.
Right. Obafemi Martins, who we're very familiar with now, covering MLS, who's a great player in our league. He goes down in history as scoring a winning goal in a cup final at Wembley. You will never get an easier goal than that to finish and put your name in lights. So I have no faith in Arsenal. And then on the Manchester United end, this game against Wolfsburg, I don't know. I don't know what the mindset and mentality is in that dressing room. They should be able to go there. I watched Wolfsburg against Borussia Dortmund this week. I wasn't very impressed by them as well as they played this season. Dortmund got the late winner from Kagawa, a former United player, but Dortmund really controlled that game. But I don't know. The one other thing I should mention, Richard, is that there is a lot of discussion that there is unrest in the dressing room at Manchester United because of the things we're talking about. The players know they can be playing in a more, in a better way, in a freer style, and expressing themselves a little more than what Van Gaal's tactics allow them to. And this reminds me, obviously the results are much better, but the top of the league is much weaker. This reminds me a little bit of Roy Hodgson's stint at Liverpool. He came in after the team had tanked under Benitez, and Hodgson tried to fit those players, some very expressive, creative players, into a very structured system, and it didn't work. Now, as it turns out, things got worse under Kenny Dalglish. Liverpool fans won't want to admit that. But the same things that were being said about Hodgson and the type of square peg, round hole thing is now being said about Van Gaal. And that's a reality. Although the flip side of this is Manchester United defensively and with De Gea in goal, they haven't given up many goals. They probably have the best defensive record in any major European league over that period since De Gea came back.
Well, the one thing that jumps out to me about this game is this could be a match where the acquisition of Bastian Schweinsteiger proves very important, not only for his leadership qualities that he brings to the team, but the familiarity that he's going to have with this particular trip midweek. Well, everybody, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to be back with you next weekend where the format will return to normal. Not only will we be talking about the top of the table first and some of the stories there, but hopefully we'll have our third co-host, Lawrence McKenna, with us. But until then, I'm Richard Farley for the rest of World Soccer Talk saying, Kartik?
Unless you're Jose Mourinho, you're enjoying your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is produced by Christopher Harris and Richard Farley and is a production of worldsoccertalk.com. For more information on the show, check us out at worldsoccertalk.com or subscribe through our iTunes feed. You can follow World Soccer Talk on Twitter at World Soccer Talk or follow the show's hosts. Lawrence McKenna is at Lawscast, Kartik Krishnar is at KKFLA737, and I'm at Richard Farley.